5 seconds, we have complete clearance for launch. We are go.
20, 9.
Guidance internal. Efficiency and start.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Out a long time ago that it's much easier to control people when we're all watching the same TV shows, listening to the same radio stations, going to the same movies, looking at the same billboards, eating the same food, and speaking the same language.
What the fuck?
I'm talking about my life. I can't seem to get that through to you. I'm not just talking about one person, I'm talking about everybody. I'm talking about form, I'm talking about content, I'm talking about interrelationships, I'm talking about God, the devil, hell, heaven! Do you understand? Finally!
All will obey Santa in this new world order! Oh yeah!
You're gonna have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
That sounds like a lot of...
There is only one holistic system of systems. One vast and immense multinational dominion of darkness. Multinational dominion
which will produce and control hallucinations to the point that it will change human reality.
PSYOP Radio.
Decoding the psychological warfare machinations within paranormal and parapolitical landscapes. Psy-Op Radio.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen. This is Smiles Lewis for another live edition, live from Austin, Texas, this July 12th, Sunday night, here on American Freedom Radio. And I'm flying solo tonight, folks. My good friend and co-host, Mac White, has not been feeling very well the past 24 hours, and a few hours ago, he wasn't feeling well again. Thankfully, last we talked, everything's good, and certainly I'm sure everything's going to be just fine, but of course, your thoughts and prayers and positive energy his way, I'm sure, will be much appreciated. This is PSYOP Radio, where we examine the convergence of the paranormal and the parapolitical, exploring the psychological warfare machinations, as the voice was saying just earlier. Tonight, it's going to be a very different show for a variety of reasons, not least of which is, as I said, I'm flying solo, but the theme of the last hour of the show, 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock tonight, is going to be specifically a remembrance and a tribute to someone in the paranormal and ufological and cryptozoological field who a lot of people don't really know about, but a lot more people do know about ever since 2002's release of the film Mothman Prophecies. This paranormal psychological thriller really introduced a lot of people to the strange, twisted worlds that UFO occupants and UFO things occupy. And which have fascinated a number of people around the planet, myself included, and which this particular paranormal investigator, John A. Keel, was a very notable figure, and he passed away back on July 3rd, and man, it's still sinking in for me, and I figured I'd explore some of those thoughts and feelings on tonight's show, and I wanted to share that with Mac. I know I'm pretty sure Mac's read some of his work, and he's certainly familiar with the ideas that Keel expressed, and we hopefully will have some guest callers in the last hour of the show from some good friends of ours who are noteworthy in the fields themselves and who have obviously been influenced by the works of John Keel, but that's coming up after 8 o'clock. In the meantime, I'm going to be going through as much news as usual, like we always do, so hope you're well stocked up on some libations. We'll be right back after these messages.
Oh, delay, oh, delay, oh, delay, oh, delay.
Don't miss Deadline Live with Jack Blood, weekday afternoons from 3 to 5, only on Freedom Underground Radio.
You'll never take control.
We're back. Welcome back to the live edition of PSYOP Radio, straight out of Austin, Texas, this July 12th, Sunday night. And again, this is Miles Lewis and Mac White in spirit, and who's over in the North Austin, Round Rock area, recovering and taking it easy tonight. Maybe he's tuned in. I hope so. If so, and if not, whatever. Love you, Mac, and you just hang in there. Everything's going to be just fine. So, folks, I wanted to tell you, besides all the news we're going to be covering this first hour, as usual, the second hour is going to be a little different. With a tribute, homage, remembrance, celebration of the life and work of John Alva Keel, who passed away just recently and who is an important luminary in the paranormal ufological field of study. We'll be talking a lot more about that after 8 o'clock. Interesting and enough, and as usual, there's articles that we'll be discussing in this first hour that'll probably be lead-ins to some of the topics discussed, and as always, we've got a ton of news, but I did want to let you know I have the phone lines open tonight, and if I can pay close enough attention to the caller screen, if you call in and don't get an immediate response from me, put on the air right away, just hang in there, because with this many browser windows open for all the news we got to cover tonight, it's, of course, hard to keep all that straight. But the number, if you've got your pencil ready, is area code 512-879-3805. That's area code 512-879-3805. We're hoping to have some call-in guests in the second half of the show, the 8 to 9 p.m. for the tribute. Those are just going to be folks that are friends, hopefully calling in and expressing what John Keel meant to them. And I'll, of course, be talking about what he meant to me. So in the meantime, you can give us a call at 512-879-3805 throughout the next hour and into the next one after that, because we'd love to hear how maybe Keel's works influenced you in your search for truth and the nature of reality. All right, what the heck to start with? I don't know, maybe a CIA chief admits CIA misled Congress? Oh, my goodness. We've got the first place I saw this was over at Rigorous Intuition Forums, and they posted a link to the dailykos.com's breaking. Panetta confirms that CIA briefers misled Congress. And then, of course, the news really started rippling out there. And it really just gets to the heart of parapolitics on Capitol Hill. Who's being told what? Who's being psyoped, blackmailed, fear-mongered into making certain decisions about policy abroad and what people were going to be bombing and maybe even what people were murdering overseas?
Getting wound up over the intelligence chief's admission that the CIA wasn't telling Congress the whole truth. Again, seven Democrat representatives are demanding to know why top secret information was kept from the country's top politicians. Well, it was initially linked to the torture interrogations, but now it's thought to be more serious than that. Well, our Dina Gazofsky can tell us more from Washington, D.C. Now, Dina, well, if it's not about waterboarding and torture, what is it that Congress could have been misled about?
Well, Alice, that's really the question on everybody's mind right now. It all seems very secretive and shady, and in some ways, it really is. Now, the other theory that's circulating around media outlets such as the Huffington Post about what this secret is could have something to do with an executive assassination ring led by none other than former Vice President Dick Cheney. That's right. Several months ago, I reported on a bombshell that investigative journalist Seymour Hersh had dropped, which basically said that under Cheney's watch, political assassinations were carried out, and there were certain members within the Central Intelligence Agency who were loyal to Dick Cheney, who helped him to plot against what they called enemy combatants. Now, fast forward to right now, you have the CIA director, Leon Panetta, coming to Congress and basically telling them, look, since 2001 till right now, we have been misleading you and some say lying about certain actions that the government was taking before. Now, no one knows
what
the actions are. It's all a big secret. The only people who were informed were the members of Congress in the House Intelligence Committee. But, Alice, my sources tell me that when Panetta dropped this bombshell, both Republicans and Democrats were absolutely stunned.
But, Dina, if these very serious allegations have any truth to them, how is it that they could go unchecked for so long?
Well, according to Hirsch and others like him, it was all about the Joint Special Operations Command, also known as JSOC. JSOC is comprised of some of the best special forces units, not just here in the United States, but all over the world. And the thing about this community is it's set up independently, so they only report to Dick Cheney. This is something that Hirsch and RT contributor and investigative journalist Wayne Mattson have been saying all along, that it was all about Dick Cheney.
Oh, Wayne
and
Mattson.
Some sources say that Leon Panetta himself, the top guy at the CIA, didn't even know what was going on at the time. Now, it's interesting because when this first story came out about this alleged executive assassination ring, some media outlets here in the United States kind of brushed it off as conspiracy theories. But now, Congress is dropping this bombshell and saying that they were stunned about what they heard from Leon Panetta, so it's fueling speculation as to whether or not the big secret could, in fact, be these political assassinations that apparently Dick Cheney was watching over. This is
really
a fascinating story.
Yes, it is fascinating. That's from Russia Today, folks. Let me know if this is being talked about in the mainstream press. Oh, wait, actually, here are some news links. Including, this is USNews.com. Democrats call for full investigation of CIA allegations. Some accuse the CIA of misleading Congress multiple times over the past 8 years. This is from Queenie Wong over at USNews.com. And, what's this? Minnesota Post, MinPost.com. Investigative reporter Seymour Hirsch describes executive assassination ring. This is from back in March of 2009. Good stuff there, folks. You should check that out. This one over at gather.com. Was the CIA hiding Cheney's executive assassination ring? July 9, 2009. The revelation from seven Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee that they were misled about a critical CIA program has sparked a debate that touches on the most sensitive areas of national security policy. What program exactly was being kept secret? No one is answering the question, citing the sensitivities that come when discussing classified intelligence matters. But in various conversations with sources on and off the Hill, two general theories have emerged. The first is that the CIA was keeping quiet about the use of waterboarding on terrorist suspects. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said, she was misled by the intelligence agency on that very subject. It's also the story told to the Huffington Post by a source with knowledge of the letter the seven House Democrats penned to CIA Chief Leon Panetta, in which they complained about being misled. Yeah. So, yeah, it's probably all theater. If anybody out there thinks that this is spontaneous, well, I suppose it's possible, and if you want to expound on that, give us a call, 879-3805. I don't know what to make of these kinds of public political hue and cry. It really is like so much in these various para fields. It's just muddy. There's so much disinfo and so much psyop, and you know, there's those things that you want to believe are real, that are not theater, that are actual humans playing out their hopes and dreams, and hopefully they're aligned with your hopes and dreams, and that's a pronoic conspiracy. But man, what's another one here? Oh, this has actually been reported over by everybody's favorite target of blame for being a supposed left-wing gatekeeper, democracynow.org. Panetta admits CIA has misled Congress. Central Intelligence Director Leon Panetta has admitted the CIA has misled Congress on intelligence matters since at least 2001. On Wednesday, a group of seven Democratic lawmakers released a letter describing Panetta's comments. House Intelligence Committee Chair Silvestri Reyes said CIA officials affirmatively lied in a recent briefing on an unspecified matter. Now, here's another one. Associated Press writer Pamela Hess over at SeattlePI.com. On eve of debate, House Democrats say CIA lied. This is July 8th, posted. CIA Director Leon Panetta told Congress last month. Yeah, this is the same stuff. exactly what actions Panetta disclosed to the House Intelligence Committee on June 24th, the birth of the modern UFO era, is unclear, but Committee Chairman Silvestri Reyes, Democrat, Texas, said that the CIA outright lied in one case. Quote, "These notifications have led me to conclude that this committee has been misled, has not been provided full and complete notifications, and in at least one case was affirmatively lied to," Reyes wrote in a letter Tuesday to Michigan Rep. Peter Hoekstra, the committee's senior Republican. A copy of the letter was obtained by the Associated Press. So there's a lot more to this. I was tuned into NPR and heard them talking about this. They were interviewing Pelosi, who, you know, they were trying to ask her leading questions, saying, hey, you know, you've talked about this. What do you think? And she was pretty much like, no, I'm not going to talk about it. You know, everything's just, this is the way things proceed. And but then they were like, well, so-and-so is saying that there's going to be an investigation. And Pelosi's like, well, did he actually say the word investigation? And they're like, yeah. And he's like, well, she's like, well, then that he may exercise that right. So maybe there'll be some getting to the bottom of this. But not wanting to feel like everything's a done deal, I'll say, sure, maybe. Good political people will start turning things around in Washington. Sure, I'm holding my breath. Gosh, what else? We've got a whole host of... What's this stuff about Hemingway? I am no Hemingway expert, unfortunately. I've never read, I don't think, a lick. But I saw this headline, sent it to a friend, and of course the friend was just like, yeah, right. This person being very much more versed in this writer's tomes. Hemingway revealed as failed KGB spy. This is from guardian.co.uk. Notes from Stalin-era intelligence. Archives show Agent Argo as a willing recruit in 1941. This is articles by John Dugdale. Mr. Dimsdale! Dimsdale! Useful in battle? Ernest Hemingway, 1944. Photograph, George Carter, Time Life Pictures. Up till now, this has been a notably cheerful year for admirers of Ernest Hemingway. A surprisingly diverse set of people who range from Michael Palin to Elmore Leonard. Almost every month has brought good news, a planned Hemingway biopic, a new improved version of his memoir, a movable feast, the opening of a digital archive of papers found in his Cuban home, progress on a movie of Islands in the Stream. Last week, however, saw the publication of Spies, the Rise and Fall of the KGB in America, Yale University Press. Dredging up some bones from someone's closet, perhaps. Which reveals the Nobel Prize-winning novelist was, for a while, on the KGB's list of its agents in America. Co-written by John Earl Haynes, Harvey Clare, and Alexander Vasiliev, the book is based on notes that Vasiliev, a former KGB officer, made when he was given access in the 90s to Stalin-era intelligence archives in Moscow. It's a section on the author's secret life as a dilettante spy draws on his KGB file in saying he was recruited in 1941 before making a trip to China, giving the cover name Argo, and, quote, repeatedly expressed his desire and willingness to help us when he met Soviet agents in Havana and London in the 40s. However, he failed to, quote, give us any political information and was never, quote, verified in practical work. So contacts with Argo had ceased by the end of the decade. Was he only ever a pseudo-spook, possibly seeing his clandestine dealings as potential literary material, or a genuine but hopelessly ineffective one? The latter reading would chime with his attempts to assist the U.S. during the Second World War in his fishing boat El Pilar, patrolling waters north of Cuba in search of U-boats, making coded notes, but only one sighting. Revelations made in recent years have not been kind to some of the writers and artists who made their reputations in the Spanish Civil War. George Orwell's list of public figures who were crypto-communists prepared for a foreign office propaganda arm in 1949 sullied his saintly image when it was published 6 years ago. Research in Soviet archives led Anthony Bivor to call Andrei Malruh a mythomaniac. Robert Capa has been accused of faking the best-known photo of that conflict. The virulent hatred of Arabs of Martha Gellhorn, Hemingway's third wife, who covered the Civil War with him, has been exposed. And now it's the turn of Hemingway himself, the biggest name of all, to lose some of his luster. Now, I don't, as I said, know much about this, but Max sent some links as well. This is from a flashback to March 2001 over at disinfo.com. Hemingway the Spy to Pawn by Preston Pete. Ernest Hemingway was one of those bigger-than-life figures looming over the literary world with a grizzled macho reputation and the hard-fisted, hard-drinking lifestyle he so loved to portray. Toward the end of his life, those around him, watching him drink the massive amounts of alcohol, naturally assumed that Hemingway was losing his mind, suffering a case of psychosis, or going, quote, increasingly delusional. But he wasn't. In fact, there were feds constantly after him for over a decade, watching his every move. Not only that, but while spying for the FBI in Cuba, he had come very close to uncovering things the U.S. government preferred him not to know. Documents released under Freedom of Information Act requests show that Hemingway was semi-hired to spy on, quote, unspecified insurgents, unquote, in Havana, and he paid with special funds by the U.S. Embassy. In 1942, the vigorously anti-fascist Hemingway organized his own small spy ring to watch for Nazi sympathizers in Cuba. Called the Crook Factory, the group was composed mainly of Hemingway's drinking circle, which was quite pervasive, as well as a few professional operatives. He bought a boat and named it Pilar, stocked it full of machine guns and homemade ordnance. Then he and others would cruise the Caribbean on the lookout for Nazi U-boats to hopefully drop a bomb down their hatch. The Times printed a story that left the reader feeling that Hemingway was an unsuccessful spy, a traitorous, wheedling backstabber for cash. According to a Hemingway biographer, he was all too willing to inform on friends who trusted him, and all for $500 a month from the FBI, which he claimed to hate. This seems to be precisely what Robert Letty, the FBI agent that was assigned to deal with Hemingway, would most like to have accomplished. The continued vilifying of Hemingway's sanity and honor nearly 40 years after his death, Hoover would have been proud. And you can read the rest of that over at disinfo.com. And there's some other links over at psyopradio.com. Hoover, Blackmail, Hemingway, and Murder by Matt Wilson. That's, I think, circa 2001, 2000 era. And what else we got? Or let me check the thing there. Before we go to the half-hour mark, a little taste of things to come. Drone wars, the rise of Skynet, dial F for Frankenstein, as well, of course, police state, take a drink, news, torture news, crime, detention, and terrorism news, gosh, just tons of links. You can go over to psyopradio.com and check it out there. We'll be right back after these messages from our sponsors. Thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned.
The president, but I don't think he did.
Welcome back, folks. Welcome back, welcome back. This is Smiles Lewis. This is Smiles Lewis on PSYOP Radio, live from Austin, Texas, this Sunday night, July 12th. Thanks for tuning in. If you've already been tuned in, you know, but if you're just tuning in, my co-host Mac White is out tonight. He's not feeling too well. This is actually I think this is the first show I've ever done of PSYOP Radio sans my good friend Mac, and usually just defer to postponing the show, but went forward tonight, and we have a planned tribute, homage, remembrance to a great in the paranormal and ufological scene planned for the second half of the show after the 8 o'clock hour this evening, so you'll be able to call in with your thoughts on the late John Alva Keel and what he meant to the UFO field. And you'll be able to call in at the Austin phone number, the area code 512-879-3805 number. So, and if you've got news that we haven't covered tonight that you'd like us to share with the world this Sunday evening, you can call that same number, this 732, and we'd love to hear from you. I was, of course, talking about the usual stuff we talk about, police state, torture, parapolitics, what it all means, looming investigations. Will there ever be any impeachments for any past war crime committers that have been our quote-unquote leaders? I don't know. Man, there's some weird news out there, you know, with the ongoing economic situation. I'm not sure what's up or down anymore. There's these two headlines that caught my attention, though. This one from SeekingAlpha.com, FDI Insurance Fund, it doesn't actually exist. I think this is by an author named Vernon Hill. When FDIC head Sheila Blair says her agency might have to bolster the FDIC's insurance fund with Treasury borrowings to pay for the new spat of bank failures, a lot of us, this 40-year-old banking veteran included, assumed there's an actual FDIC fund in need of bolstering. We were wrong. As a former FDIC chairman, Bill Isaac, points out here, link, the FDIC insurance fund is an accounting fiction. It takes in premiums from banks, then turns those premiums over to the Treasury, which adds the money to the government's general coffers for, quote, spending on missiles, school lunches, water projects, and the like. The insurance premiums aren't really premiums at all, therefore, they're a tax by another name. Actually, it's worse than that. The FDIC, persisting in the myth that its fund really is an insurance pool, now promises to raise the premiums it charges banks to make up for the fund's coming shortfall. The financially weakest banks will be hit with the biggest tax hikes. Which makes absolutely no sense. You don't need me to tell you the banking industry is on the ropes. The last thing it needs, or the recovery, or the economy needs, for that matter, is an expense hike that will inhibit banks' ability to rebuild capital, extend new loans, or both. If the FDIC wants to raise its bank tax once the industry is recovered, I suppose that's fine, but to raise taxes on the industry now is perhaps the dumbest thing the agency can possibly do. At the margin, the FDIC will be helping bring about more of the failures it says it wants to prevent. There's more over at SeekingAlpha.com, and the link is at PSIOPRadio.com. This other one that's on a similar theme caught my attention from Washington.BizJournals.com, Washington Business Journal Economist, FDIC gearing up for bank closures. From Janet Leisure, contributing writer, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp is gearing up to handle a large number of bank failures expected as a result of bad mortgages, both in residential and commercial real estate, an economist said Tuesday. Quote, they know they're going to take down a large number of banks, and they can't do it until they're staved off. Staffed up. Said Mark Dotzur, chief economist and director of research for the Real Estate Center at Texas A&M University. Dotzur expects federal regulators to establish an agency similar to the Resolution Trust Corp that disposed of assets belonging to involvement at insolvent SNLs in the late 1980s and early 1990s. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, does that ring a bell to anybody? The freaking savings and loan scandals, the repeat... the precursor, rather, of what we're seeing now, and whose cronies were in power? The Bush families. Yeah, look into it. It's pretty interesting history, parapolitically speaking, with ties to international banking criminals, BCCI, the Bank of Criminals, and yada, 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 international. Bleh. All right. So, meanwhile, in the torture vein... Man, it is so obvious to me, and I think anybody who will take a moment to look, that besides the militarization of law enforcement, there is also going on this massive change in philosophy on a public scale where we, as a society, are becoming even more complicit in torture and torture-induced compliance and this whole kind of prison police state. And it's all based on the allowance of the possibility that torture might actually be good for something. And getting into these realms that the Bush administration and other administrations' long history in the United States of suspending habeas corpus and indefinitely detaining people. We've got this one out of Wall Street Journal. Detainees, even if acquitted, might not go free, by Jess Bravin. The title speaks for itself. If you've been following this, you know that the Bush administration, like the Bush administration, the Obama administration argues that the legal basis for indefinite detention of aliens it considers dangerous is separate from war crimes prosecutions. Officials say that the laws of war allow indefinite detention to prevent aliens from committing warlike acts in future, while prosecution by military commission aims to punish them for war crimes committed in the past. Let's punish some of our war criminals for their past, present, and ongoing war crimes, including the drone war that we'll be getting to in a little bit. Here from original.antiwar.com is Texas harboring torture decider, Ray McGovern, July 9th. Editor's note, prior to giving some talks in Texas later this week, the author offered the following op-ed to the Dallas Morning News and the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Both newspapers in George W. Bush's home state turned it down. Surprise. Seldom does a crime scene have so clear a smoking gun. A two-page presidential memorandum of February 7, 2002 leaves no room for uncertainty regarding the decider on torture. His broad-stroke signature made torture official policy. This should come as no surprise. You see, the February 7, 2002 memorandum has been posted on the web since June 22, 2004, when then-White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez mistakenly released it, along with other White House memoranda. The title seemed innocent enough, Humane Treatment of Al-Qaeda and Taliban Detainees. But in the body of the memo, President George W. Bush authorized his senior aides to withhold Geneva Convention protections from suspected Al-Qaeda and Taliban detainees. Like Shakespeare, the media seem harshest on the lawyers, including Texans Gonzalez and William J. Hines II, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's lawyer, who later outdid themselves trying to make torture legal. What gets lost in the woodwork is this. Banal as their ex post facto justification for torture was, the lawyers were not the deciders. After the decider-in-chief, the key decision-makers were the eight addressees of the February 7th memorandum. Vice President Dick Cheney, Secretary of State Colin Powell, Rumsfeld, Attorney General John Ashcroft, White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card, CIA Director George Tenet, National Security Aide Condoleezza Rice, and Joint Chiefs Chairman Richard Myers. During the Q&A after a recent Myers talk in Washington, I asked him what he did after he had read the president's memo on ignoring Geneva. The tone of his non-answer was this. If the president wanted to dismiss Geneva, what was a mere chairman of the Joint Chiefs to do? In his memoir, Eyes on the Horizon, he tries to blame the lawyers. Quote, by relying so heavily on just the lawyers, the president did not get the broader advice on these matters that he needed. Unquote. Myers and other seven addressees might these days be called derivative deciders, or more simply, accomplices. There is not a shred of evidence that any of the gang of eight gave the slightest consideration to resigning rather than carry out the president's decision. They elected to just follow orders. A defense dismissed out of hand at the post-W2 Nuremberg Tribunal on war crimes. Together with the lawyer advisors, the derivative deciders provide abundant proof that the banality of evil did not die with Adolf Eichmann and other functionaries of the Third Reich. And you can go on. And yeah, here's CIA, ex-CIA Ray McGovern, and some say still CIA Ray McGovern, who's somehow damaging the left's anti-war stance. I don't know. I think that there are good CIA people out there. I think that, you know, the CIA is not in and of itself evil, even though we know it's done immeasurable evil, and really that tends to make me think of everything connected to it as evil, but we can't be that broad and sweeping, I don't think. What do you think? Why don't you give us a call at area code 512-879-3805 if you care. Maybe we will do just that. Hey, I think we have a caller. Let's see. Oh, crap. Wrong one. Okay, now I think I've, this is area code 530. Are you there? Hello, caller. Can you hear me?
Hello?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Oh, you're breaking.
No doubt. What's on your mind? All right. Well, try back again. That's area code 512-879-3805. I know sometimes it can be hard to hear through these weird telephony things, but give it a try. We'd love to hear from you. So that was Is Texas Harboring Torture Decider by Ray McGovern over at antiwar.com. And, here's some possibly good news. Maybe finally Roe deposed in U.S. attorney probe? You mean Roe's getting probed? It's about time, some would say. John Brisnahan and Josh Gerstein over at politico.com have posted this article. Former White House Deputy Chief of Staff Karl Rove was deposed Tuesday by attorneys for the House Judiciary Committee, according to Representative John Conyers, Democrat Michigan, the panel's chairman. Rove's deposition began at 10 a.m. and ended around 6:30 p.m. with several breaks, Conyers said. Conyers would not comment on what Rove told congressional investigators, surprise, surprise, what the next step in the long-running Judiciary Committee investigation would be, or whether Rove would face additional questioning. Now, okay, isn't it Conyers who I think I signed a petition for to impeach the president or to at least investigate his crimes? And then Conyers was approached again to follow through on that and didn't, right? Didn't he and all those Democrats put aside the partisanness of impeachment? What the heck, folks? We need accountability. I mean, for goodness sake, this government has been so criminal so long. Let's just start. Let's start being accountable. Let's start holding these people accountable. So that's Rove deposed in U.S. Attorney Probe over at Politico.com. And I was talking about torture. Everybody's doing it. It's the brand new dance now, don't you know? Mexico accused of torture and drug war. Army using brutality to fight trafficking, rights groups say. That's over from the Washington Post. There's also ex-official UK subcontracted torture of terrorist suspect to Pakistan over at RawStory.com. Accused of returning to terrorism, former Gitmo detainee, a respected Afghan politician, that's another one from over at rawstory.com, revealed, another one from guardian.co.uk, the secret torture evidence MI5 tried to suppress. That's got to be pretty interesting. But, yeah, Mexican army using torture in drug war. War is crime, folks. Puerto Los Olas, Mexico. The Mexican army has carried out forced disappearances, acts of torture, and illegal raids in pursuit of drug traffickers, according to documents and interviews with victims, their families, political leaders, and human rights monitors. From the violent border cities where drugs are brought into the United States to the remote highland regions where poppies and marijuana are harvested, residents and human rights groups describe an increasingly brutal war in which the government, led by the army, is using harsh measures to battle the cartels that continue to terrorize much of the country. Now, granted, the cartels are apparently also using quite harsh techniques here, but, you know, this is... When you outlaw things, you get outlaws. When you criminalize drugs, you make criminals of drug users, which is just silly and ridiculous and pathetic. So, and not very freedom and liberty-oriented like this country is supposed to be. Yeah, I'm preaching to the choir, aren't I? All right, well, we'll be right back after these messages. Stay tuned. Welcome back. Welcome back to another episode. Another episode of PSYOP Radio. Live from AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Here in Austin, Texas, July 12th, 2009. I want to share this little funny clip that pretty much says is all that needs to be said about the Second Amendment in a lot of ways. My good friend Carlos turned me on to. I think you'll recognize the voice here.
Second Amendment. gun control. You've been on the NRA's board since 95, mm-hmm. and this is a subject that you maybe feel more strongly about than any other.
I believe that
make your case.
I believe that a person's moral compass can be determined by how he references free men the right to defend themselves. The Second Amendment is so obvious to me, it's insane that there's an argument. God gave, let's pretend there is no document. Let's pretend brave families didn't leave the tyrants and the slave drivers of Europe so that they could practice the religion of their choice, so that they could speak out without being murdered, that they could produce wool without the king's men coming and taking it from them every season of harvest. Let's pretend none of that happened. Let's just pretend this guy named Ted Nugent parachuted onto Earth and woke up one morning and saw these wonderful resources and had dreams of excellence and being the best that I could be. I don't need a document, and I don't need another man to explain to me that I have the right to defend my gift of life, and that there is an argument in America from Hillary Clinton, from Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, from a whole gaggle of numbnuts who would try to tell me they will dictate where, how, and if I can defend myself. I find that preposterous. I find it unacceptable, and I will not accept it. I am a free man. Don't tread on me. A good, law-abiding citizen, not convicted of a felon, the Second Amendment of our Bill of Rights is my concealed weapons permit. Period.
That's it?
That's it.
So no limitations of any kind that you can see?
None.
That's it.
The limitation should be, instead of arresting people for molesting children 24 times, I would rather the dad walked into the room, found a person molesting that child, and blew his brains out. I would rather that the lady in Massachusetts last month, who was taking her daughter to soccer, who was carjacked by a recidivistic maggot who'd been in the prison system all his life but was let out again because we feel sorry for him. Maybe he had a bad childhood. Instead of her being hijacked and murdered, I'd rather she just shot the bastard dead. But in Massachusetts, somebody decided she can't do that. So she's dead. I would rather she was alive and the carjacker was dead. I'm weird. I would rather that the guy who beat this lady to within an inch of her life in Waco, on parole was he, phenomenal, and beat her to within an inch of her life in front of her grandchildren with a whiskey bottle, I would rather she fell to the ground, pulled out a .38, and shot him 6 times in the chest and killed him. Am I weird? Because the guy is going to get out again.
Oh, man.
I don't like repeat offenders.
Yeah,
I like
obviously.
Dead offenders.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. That was from KLRU Austin, Texas, folks. That was, of course, the always vocal about his perspective, Ted Nugent, on Texas Monthly Talks. Thank you, Carlos, for that link. I would have missed it otherwise. Often some very interesting things coming out of Texas Monthly, good and bad. I hearken back always to their Bum Steer Awards where they implicated the FBI in provocateuring KKK groups to bomb chemical factories. It's like, yep. All right. And, man, what other – there's so much news that I know we didn't even get to. Oh, hey, where is – this bit here. I haven't even heard this yet, folks. Let's see if the...
Well, they just get worked up and start pulling all the hay on us. I think if we have this kind of response and then it develops, we could start it with our own destroyers. That people are going to conclude and correctly and unjustly, but could we just play the cops, you know, trying to get a lot of attention and trying to show how tough we are. I want to be tough where we need to be tough and where we justify being tough, and I will do whatever is necessary, but I sure want more caution on the part of these admirals and these destroyer commanders, whoever they are, about whether they're being fired on or not. I don't want to just have some change-of-life woman running up and saying that she's being raped.
All right. So that's Robert McNamara, deceived LBJ on Gulf of Tonkin, documents show. This is a recording, apparently, between McNamara and LBJ, I believe. Anyway, there's some really good coverage over at Raw Story Exclusive. Robert McNamara, deceived LBJ on Gulf of Tonkin, documents show, as well as Alexander Coburn's Cockburn's Counterpunch website. McNamara, from the Tokyo Firestorm to the World Bank. Yeah, he's his hands are pretty dirty. We were just talking about him, but he's passed away too. My goodness. Whole ages are passing, folks. May we live in interesting times. We certainly do, folks. Live in very interesting times. And coming up in the next hour, we're going to be reflecting on the life and works of a very influential paranormal researcher by the name of John Alva Keel. And I hope you'll stick around and join us. And I hope you'll give us a call. We are taking phone calls tonight. The number is 512-879-3805. We'll be right back. Back to the second hour of this live July 12th, 2009 edition of PSYOP Radio. I am your host, Smiles Lewis, and unfortunately tonight I am flying solo without my co-host, Mac White, who is out sick and recovering and on the mend, and will be back next time, I'm sure, and all of our hopes and prayers and positive energy go to him as we traverse these wonderful worlds. Let's see. So this is the second hour, and we have hopefully gotten word out that we're doing a tribute, homage, remembrance of the recently passed paranormal and ufological and cryptozoological luminary John Alva Keel. Now, a lot of people probably really aren't very familiar with his work, but if you've been paying attention out there, you've probably seen movies like The Mothman Prophecies, which may not immediately make one think of UFOs, but which is one of those defining books, defining movies, defining idea complexes that has really energized the UFO and paranormal fields upon its release back in the 70s. The Mothman Prophecies, an investigation into the mysterious American visits of the infamous Feathery Garuda by John Alva Keel, who, as we say, just passed away July 3rd, right before the 4th of July, 2009. He was born March 25th, 1930, and that book, The Mothman Prophecies, and the particular version of the cover that I've included over at psyopradio.com, that was my introduction to his work was that particular printing run edition of Mothman Prophecies with the line drawing, very detailed and yet kind of comic bookish, a white and black cover with kind of a purple pinkish Mothman Prophecies title and weird background color on the cover there. And this book really turned me on to a number of ideas which I was stumbling across in other venues in the parapsychological and ufological literature, and that was the idea that UFOs are much more than just extraterrestrials, aliens, space brothers, or what have you in the modern myth sense, that they have a much richer meaningfulness if you look at them in terms of anthropology, folklore, myth, and various cultures throughout humanity's history on this planet. If you look at this phenomena, you can learn a lot about human history, because human history is a story of people being ruled by their myths, their belief systems. And these myths and belief systems seem to have a control system there. Now, this is an idea that we'll explore a little more coming up. But again, this is PSYOP Radio, live by American Freedom Radio. And this hour, we're going to be honoring the memory of paranormal ufologist John Alva Keel. And we'd love to hear from you tonight. You can give us a call at area code 512-879-3805. I'm Smiles Lewis. This is PSYOP Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to PSYOP Radio. This is Smiles Lewis, and we're in just getting started on our homage, remembrance, tribute to the late paranormal ufologist John Alva Keel. And my co-host, Mac White, is sitting this one out tonight. He's getting over not feeling well, but we wish him well. And we invite you all to give us a call tonight at 512-879-3805 to talk about the memory of John Keel and what he means to the UFO fields, paranormal fields, and you personally, perhaps. In fact, I think we do have a caller who's been waiting patiently. Let's go to area code 207. Hello, caller. Can you hear me?
Hi, this is Lawrence Coleman Smiles.
Mr. Coleman, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine.
Well,
I'm glad to be here with you.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
I was positively surprised to hear from you when you informed me that it's again your birthday, as it is every year. And thank you for joining us this evening. My goodness. Now, see, with Keel, he talked about how there was all kinds of weird phone stuff. So how can we tell? I recognize your voice, but he reported that in his Mothman chronicling, he was experiencing a whole range of strange phone problems. So how can I really be sure it's you, except that I'm looking at the number and going, yeah, I think that's our Lauren there.
You don't have caller ID? My goodness.
Well, it didn't pull up your name, but
right.
It's good to hear from you. Thank you for joining me this evening. And boy, goodness, you
were.
Well,
it's been a shocking week, you know. Friday, July 3rd, Keel dies, and then I write my obituary when I hear the news on Monday. And then I get contacted by his family, who had not heard that he died yet.
Oh.
And because of the obituary, I told them where the hospital was and that things, and they found his body in the morgue unclaimed. So it just got from more bizarre to, you know, weird. And that's kind of typical of what I would have expected for John Keel's passing. So it was, you know, it's just been quite a week with a lot of people talking to me about this and me talking to the family. So I'm glad to be here talking about John.
Well, he meant a lot to me. I was just relating how that particular Garuda cover that I reproduced from your CryptoMundo.com site, the site you write for, that was the first inkling I ever had of Mr. Keel was the Mothman Prophecies, and that was, I guess, a lot of people's introduction with the movie. But that book, for me, really started concretizing what I was finding in other lesser known areas of the ufological spectrum of research, was this acknowledgement of other areas of import beyond simply a cryptozoological interpretation of strange creatures that seem alien and unknown to humans, but also this connection to the folklore surrounding these balls of light phenomena. And Keel often talked about these balls of light resolving into either a creature or a structured craft, and that seemed to be at the heart of a lot of what he seemed to be saying about the nature of this weird phenomenon. Did that inform your idea of these phenomena at the time, or if so, has it changed?
Well, I think we have to back up. For me, I knew Keel from the middle of the 60s, and the Mothman Prophecies book came out in 1975, but long before that, John and I had been corresponding and, you know, talking on the phone once in a while. But I helped him quite a bit with his book, Strange Creatures from Time and Space, which came out in 1970. And if you recall, I think it was Operation Trojan Horse in 1970, and about the same time with Strange Creatures. And in Strange Creatures, he had a whole appendix about the sightings of Mothman, and he'd actually written his article about the Mothman in Flying Saucer Review. And his views of Mothman really evolved. He was a good friend of Ivan Sanderson, as I was. Ivan, being a biologist, really talked to Keel about the biology and the sort of the nuts and bolts. And so Keel from 1966 to 1967 changed from someone who was a Fortean looking for tangible evidence to someone, as he told me later in life, who would never call himself a ufologist, but he called himself a demonologist.
Mm.
And so all of his way of looking at the world really became much more sinister, much more psychological, and much more demonological. So, no, I wasn't informed by Keel's new journey, but what I did like about Keel was he was a thinker, he was an intellectual. You know, for somebody that dropped out of high school and ran away to Greenwich Village, he was a very intelligent man. And I liked that about him, although, you know, we can talk maybe later about how he became cranky later on. But, you know, so by the time that he wrote Mothman Prophecies, he was fully in the midst of what I really think was his blender mood. You know, you'd throw in a psychic, you'd throw in a UFO case, you'd throw in a mechanical robot case and some reports of Mothman, and you sort of mix it all together. Then you have MITs and, you know, Men in Black cases, and cases of strange Orientals showing up and cattle mutilation. For Keel, it all became all one thing. And I think for people that are new to John Keel and read the Mothman Prophecies, which were, in many ways was his, as I said to some friends of mine the other day, John Keel's The Mothman Prophecies is Fortiana's In Cold Blood.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Because he very much took a case that was going on and took some things that personally were happening happening to him in New York, in many ways paralleling Truman Capote's sort of approach to it all, to, you know, the crime that he talked about in Cold Blood. And Kiel, sometimes you can't tell when he's fictionalizing something, when he's giving dialogue that he sort of remembered versus some that he made up. And it all kind of goes together in a beautiful book. And even the opening of the book, you know, with the storm crackling across the horizon, has many, you know, a feel about it that is more like a novel than it is a nonfiction book.
Indeed, and I think that's what led to it being a successful adaptation to the film, to the silver screen, was that they were able to, while changing some of the facts and details, really capture the mood and the ambiance that his writing for that particular book has. I'm holding a copy of the paperback of J.D. I couldn't find my hardback. I went over to the Anomaly Archives today, grabbing up all the Kiel books I could find so that I could refresh my memory and look back. And I got to reread so many of these, but I've still never read J.D., the greatest book ever written on the black magic of the Orient.
It has his case where he's following a Yeti, you know, and he sees two abominable snowmen in the jungle. So Kiel thought it was his autobiography. Considering how young he was, he had quite a big ego about writing his autobiography so early. But that was Kiel for you.
Well, he apparently did. He has a very colorful life. I was just going over some notes, and apparently he used to write one-liners or comebacks for the Merv Griffin or something, and or at least I think he's on tape saying such a thing. This thing where he was part of a broadcast from inside the pyramids at a time when that kind of thing was just really technologically challenging. I agree that, as you were saying, he really kind of put together a lot of smorgasbord paranormal books where some might criticize him as kind of lumping all these things together and, as you're saying, putting things from his personal life and other cases that he investigated. And certainly there have been folks who've criticized him. Even some of his biggest fans have criticized him for, either getting a thing wrong here or there to... I've just been reading Jacques Vallée's Forbidden Science, Volume 2, and of course there's several references to Kiel in there and how exciting how excited folks in the field were at the time of each of his books coming out and the ideas that they were spreading. And but there's an interesting story in there where Vallée says that they were able to pronounce something an IFO after some deeper research, and that he'd informed Kiel, but apparently Kiel didn't change that and before the book went to press or whatever. But and I know I was just seeing in one of your books where Kiel changed a name of a witness just slightly to protect the innocent, or just got it slightly different. Something I saw you call attention to in one of your books.
I think typos or, you know, definitely a kind of less than scholarly approach to it. Jacques Vallée, of course, very much from the academic world,
right,
would heavily footnote his books, and yet Vallée and Kiel and myself and Clark and Brad Steiger and all of these folks were going back and forth with each other, you know, feeding information, feeding cases. The good old days when we actually wrote letters to each other, in which we'd get two or three letters from each other with photocopies of articles and raw source material. It was just an exciting time. And of all of us, Kiel was the one that he was more interested in the theories or in the personalities of the people or even some of his intellectual ideas about ultra-terrestrials than some of the rest of us that were very exacting on the details of the cases and the locations and the dates. And, you know, I think all of us just grew to understand that about Kiel, and that was fine. I think that historians looking later, if they go through Keel's book, they may be dissatisfied, but people have done that to Charles Fort now, too, and annotated his material and corrected him. So it's just part of sort of the Fortean game.
Yeah, it's part of the scientific process of, you know, accumulating data, right, and refining it, getting the details more accurately nailed down in the archives. And Keel definitely had the reputation and the attitude of an adventure writer. You know, he was going off into the world early on to experience some of these things himself and to go try to answer some of the crazy questions about the nature of our reality and the strange stories that we hear told from person to person, from culture to culture. And that whole kind of mystery of the Orient approach he took with Jadu. And it did, though, later, I think, it really suits anomalous and Fortians to be able to, you know, look at a widely variable set of phenomena and sometimes see patterns and note them. And that's what I think a lot of what he did. And UFOs Operation Trojan Horse was, I paid $35 for this UK 1973 edition at my first UFO conference in 1992. And I've cherished it ever since. It's got so much great data in there. But he's right off the bat in there, you know, talking about patterns in the phenomena and his collecting of over 10,000 clippings and reports by 1966, and you know, being able to note certain patterns, like what day of the week it might be more likely to see a UFO, and that would be Wednesday, with trending towards Thursday. So, and that particular book actually is indexed, which is another reason I splurged and got that, because so many of the collections of weird Fortean anomalous reports don't always have the best indexes and that sort of thing. But I, having never had the opportunity to meet Keel, and having had the opportunity to meet you and correspond with you, and my experience with the 1990s zine scene gave me a brief taste of what that must have been like when the snail mail was the primary mode of transmitting the samizdat of data, these Xeroxed research notes and the wonderful long letters that unfortunately seem to have been replaced by the instantaneousness of digital electronic communication. But again, there's that electronic communication thing that seemed to be such a part of Keel's Mothman experience. We're going to be getting close to the end of the half hour here, Lauren, so just want to give a heads up on that. But I guess if you could tell us what the flavor was of your interactions with him early on. I mean, what was his personality like?
Well, early on, Keel and I really were colleagues. I was younger, of course. I'm 17 years younger or so than him. So he wasn't quite like a mentor. My mentor was definitely Ivan Sanderson, and Ivan knew John. And then, but it was through Keel, for instance, that I met Jerry Clark, because Keel introduced Jerry and I through letters, and then Brad Steiger. And so what Keel and I would do is we'd exchange articles and we'd exchange ideas. And I was very interested very early on, and I actually have to dig out my letters from Keel, because we would talk about names. We would talk about the name game before either one of us really published on it, way back in the 60s. And he very much, because he'd done so much database, he would come up with some strange names that would keep coming up, like Reeves. And then, you know, I'd mentioned the Wetzel stories of the, you know, people that had seen Bigfoot kind of lizard men type creatures out in California, and the kangaroo and in the Midwest being named Wetzel. And we'd go back and forth on that. It was very much, it was fun, but it was also kind of like, what the heck's going on here kind of letters.
Yeah.
And then we would start meeting each other occasionally at the International Fortean Organization conference, in which, where I met both Mosley, James Mosley, and Keel there. And some people came up to me and they said, my gosh, I thought you were in your your 60s because you'd been writing letters to me for so long. So I would startle people by being in my 20s, you know, yeah. because I'd been so active for so long. But it was fun, and you know, and then Keel would and I would meet each other here and there, and we got had a lot of interaction, mostly on the phone, when he was doing when the Mothman movie came out, because he was so sick and he was he just kind of fended off the studios for doing the radio interviews, and I did the radio interviews.
Yeah,
that was fun.
All right, well, we can continue that discussion on the other side of these commercials if you're willing, Lauren. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. This is PSYOP Radio on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. This is Smiles Lewis on PSYOP Radio, live from Austin, Texas. It's 8:30, and we've got Lauren Coleman on the line, and we're talking about the memory of and works of John Alva Keel, who's a very famous paranormal and demonological writer who wrote such titles as UFOs, Operation Trojan Horse, Disneyland of the Gods, Jadu, and, of course, I think I already said, Mothman Prophecies. One of the chapter titles in Mothman Prophecies is, "Even the Bedouins Hate Their Telephone Company," which is cited as from the 1967 movie, The President's Analyst, in which the idea is expressed that there's a even more darker, weirder alphabet agency out there that's... not the CIA, not the FBI, but TPC, TPC, Telephone Company. And is it an artificial intelligence? Again, this theme in the Mothman Prophecies, that some of the personal experiences that were besetting John Keel in the form of strange phone calls, strange phenomena happening with electronic devices. Did he ever talk to you about his experiences as a 12-year-old on a farmhouse? Does that ring any bells?
No, well, no. I mean, I've read about it where he, you know, saw different things and almost poltergeist-type activity and different things. But why don't you go ahead and tell that story?
Well, from the best of my recollection, he says that at the age of 12, living on this farmhouse, that at night he was hearing these knockings in the wall, and that he actually started seemingly communicating with whatever force, intelligence, whatever was at work, and in such a way that he felt convinced that he was communicating with some other discarnate intelligence. And I certainly think that that has informed a lot of his ideas, and that certainly can lead to an interpretation of so many of these phenomena as being demonological, because certainly there's the world-famous book, The Bible, where they talk about demons and fallen angels who don't always have the best interest at heart of humanity. And, of course, the very story at the heart of the Mothman Prophecies is a disaster, and it's the portents and strange phenomena that seem to precede it and predict it. A lot of what you've written about, as you were starting to say, deals with the name game and these strange synchronicities, these meaningful coincidences, sometimes between UFO reports and kangaroos, out-of-place kangaroo sightings, and the name game, where names that are not the most common that you would think statistically would come up more often than not don't in UFO reports. In fact, these other Reeves, Warren, Lafayette, and others come up over and over again. Can you talk about how you developed your ideas about that and how Keel saw that?
Well, Well, in terms of Keel's way of looking at it, even though he used the word demonological, he very much felt that there were elementals and ultra-terrestrials, as he called them. They were here. They lived in a parallel universe to us. I mean, some people like to talk about fourth dimension, but Keel almost felt like they were just among us, and we did not have the ability most of the time to really see them because they were out of our range of sight. But that these entities or this form of intelligence was so intelligent that they would actually manipulate human beings by showing us different phenomena, either coincidences with names, harmonic interactions on you know, Wednesdays after the 21st of the month, especially in April, for instance, on the ridges of hills. So he had a very complex way of looking at the world, which was, I mean, I think in many ways, one of my friends on a radio show recently said, you know, he was crazy. He was, and if you look at it from a distance, this is a crazy man who is speaking intellectually and putting it down in print and coming forth with a lot of different Freudian examples and old cases and different things that kind of makes it all come together. His own poltergeist-type experiences, very much for Keel, overlapped with the Fox sisters. And Keel was in many ways obsessed with and talked to me quite a bit about the year 1848. 1848 was a year, if you look around the globe, there were revolutions all over Europe, all over the United States, and it was the kind of, and there was this one special area called the Burned Over area, the Burned Over region, which is in around Rochester, New York. And in that one area, you have Mormonism, Seventh-day Adventists, abolitionism, a lot of different religions and cults and, you know, the Fox sister and spiritualism all coming out of this region, all close in time and space. And Keel made a very big deal of that feeling that was the ultra-terrestrials really playing games. And he liked to use the word cosmic jokers, that they were really, you know, being cosmic jokers and just manipulating. So sometimes Keel would, even though he would use the word demonological, it wasn't oftentimes demons the way that Christians see demons, but it was more demons in terms of tricksters and elementals and parallel universes. In other words, just a word like angel. I mean, he felt that angels could be just as nasty as demons, and it was really talking about humans trying to give a label to something that he felt was just around us and getting a good laugh based upon how they were making fun of humans.
Exactly. I think he definitely saw, as you say, this sense of every culture has had different words for these, and demons is the more Western anglicized version, and each culture has these kind of trickster elements that sometimes don't necessarily have bad intentions, but are definitely out to mess with your sense of the nature of reality and to maybe even educate you. And I think I got a sense, and I know like people who like Dr. Stephen Misrach, who's a good friend of mine, who has written on Keel's ideas and really wrote a really great movie review of the Mothman movie, comparing it to the book, and sees this. His Keel's appreciation of this multicultural aspect, and that these entities have often contacted people and seem to influence human history in ways that implies what Valais directly called a control system, and what Keel intimates a lot in his work, you know, conjuring imagery of quote unquote mind control sleepers and UFOs as psychological warfare propaganda, and yet at the heart of that, having a very spiritualist sense. Again, he himself invoked, as you say, this memory of the Fox sisters and their, you know, interfacing with this other realm, He really seems to give a sense of the world, the sense of magicalness and this aliveness that I think both Ivan Sanderson talked about and Terrence McKenna and a number of other people, this idea that that the planet is alive and that this phenomenon is one aspect of its aliveness, and that we, you know, interact with it in ways that end up influencing our history in pretty grandiose ways, the creation of religious movements and whole ways of thinking about the hierarchy of existence.
I think one of the cautionary tales, though, coming out of Kiel that is not really realized yet by a lot of people that are really devotees of Kiel, is that if you compare, for instance, the personality of Ivan Sanderson, a really happy-go-lucky Scotsman who enjoyed people, who was very social, who laughed a lot, compared to the Kiel personality, where he was very closed, often paranoid, oftentimes very sarcastic, you know, using the excuse that he was trying to use the humor of Charles Fort, but it would come out with a kind of a tinge to it that sometimes was extremely mean. And so when I went down to Point Pleasant, for instance, in 2001, 2002, to re-interview some of the, you know, the Linda Scarberry and Marcella Bennett and some of the early witnesses, the stories that I would hear of the influence that Kiel had on the lives of, for instance, Linda, where she said that after she talked to Kiel, Kiel had scared her so much that she put crosses on every one of her walls in her house, and she had a mental health breakdown, was in a hospital, and looks like a skeleton based upon really being stirred up, and as opposed to her early writings and reports were that she saw a bird, to later, if you read some of the more recent interview, she talks about this thing, you know, having arms and legs, and you can even read in Kiel's first Flying Saucer Review, he said that none of the Mothman reports had arms, but they changed and evolved almost as if Kiel's personality really evolved the field. So I'm very kind of cautious today about how Kiel changed, and he's taken along with him a lot of people that are followers in almost a cult-like way, and I call it Kiel's spawn. And it's a very negative, very sinister. His appendix on his tour, the 2001 tour edition of his Mothman Prophecies, is one of the most caustic appendix that I've ever seen written by a writer, talking about how other writers had quoted him or, you know, cited him. Kiel was not a happy man towards the end of his life, and that very much was reflected in a lot of things that he did with other people, a lot of things that he wrote, and how he kind of really cut himself off, and it really, I kind of understand how he ended up very alone when he died. And it's very sad to see that have happened. But his sort of sinister nature of his writing, reflective of his personality, really became part of his personality in a very damaging way that I've talked to many people this week, and they all felt, you know, cut off from him. His family was cut off. He would tell other writers, don't contact me. He would tell all of us, don't send him any fan mail, you know, and all of that. And it was just very sad to see at the end of his life.
Indeed. Reading your entry about that, it was very moving and disturbing, and yet, as you say, it almost has a certain logical ring to it. In fact, in the movie Mothman Prophecies, where they've more or less split his character into the two characters played by Richard Gere and the actual demonologist character played by the actor whose name eludes me at the moment, but
Alan Bates.
And he the Stephen Mizrak's review was reminding me of how the director was able to kind of explore the different sides of Kiel's investigative aspect versus his, you know, kind of paranoid aspect, seeing things in demonological terms. It's a spooky book, and I think I've kind of had that flavor in running through his other works, and to some degree it strikes me as there's a little bit of that quality in most Fortians, and certainly Charles Fort's idea of humanity as property is kind of provocative and makes one think that the phenomena is kind of out to get us. So I guess I hope that he wasn't at the last part of his life really feeling too much angst towards other people, even at the time that we know he was pushing people away to arm's length at the very least. You know, I think some folks really appreciate folks giving them space, and they need to go through what they got to go through. But this is PSYOP Radio. We'll talk about this a little more on the last segment here on the other side of these messages. Stay with us. Survive. Look to the earth and not the sky if you want to survive. That was one of the main messages, in a sense, from John Kiel, is that these beings, these entities from elsewhere, whatever they are, they lie. He often referenced Swedenborg, and this was an idea that many a researcher has pointed out, that across the annals of history where humanity has found itself in contact with these alien others, their messages and prophecies aren't always to be believed. And we've got Lauren Coleman on the line, and we've been discussing the life and work of John Alva Kiel, who just passed away this July 3rd, 2009. And I think one of the things I wanted to read was from my good friend Stephen Mizrak, who I mentioned earlier. He has written a tribute. I can't read the whole thing right now, but he talks about the concurrences between Valet and John Kiel in terms of their talking about the phenomena might be ultra-terrestrial and not necessarily extraterrestrial, that the phenomena has historical roots deeper than 1947, that the phenomena seem to respond to people's beliefs. And that's Kiel always cautioned people that belief is the enemy. And four, that one should be cautious of the ufological establishment. And five, that the phenomena was part of something that could be considered a control system, whereas Valet seems to think of it as more positive. Kiel tended to think of it as negative. And as Lauren was just saying, this seemed to find its way into the after effects of these phenomena's contact and effects on other people, in the creation of folks who are perhaps a little too into John Kiel. Is that what you're saying, Mr. Coleman?
Well, I think that if you want to be a good Fortian, you should be skeptical of everything.
Yes.
All writers, you know, myself included, and yet you find whirling around the Mothman, death curses, bad luck, light bulbs exploding, phone troubles. And I don't know if that's from Kiel's personality or from the Mothman phenomena in and of itself, but it's certainly, of all of the ones, it's one of the strangest that has a lot of sinister bad luck connected to it.
Indeed.
I hope you don't have to drive home tonight.
No, thankfully, no. I am sitting at home as we speak. I know that that's something that you've chronicled a lot is mysterious deaths, and not just in the paranormal field, but in the parapolitical field as well.
Right.
And Kiel, you know, I wouldn't ever really characterize him as a conspiracy theorist, but as a paranoid, yeah, he definitely saw that there were powers and principalities running the world, and in some of his lectures was often referencing the people who, you know, start wars over oil and that sort of thing.
He was very interested in the crypto-political, and he would talk about this on and on, talking about assassinations, and the JFK assassination really interested him, and Grassy Knoll and all of those things. He didn't write that much about it, but he certainly would keep you up late at night at conferences in the waiting room of the hotel or whatever, just talking on and on about a lot of his. And I believe, being from New York and being in Greenwich Village, he had a lot of friends that were connected to a lot of people that were very political. So he brought some of that into his own way of looking at the world, of course.
Sure. Taking in all the data points and constructing a map of reality. In the Mothman prophecies, there's a lot made in the scenes dealing with the female characters' dream premonitions of the disaster that would befall Point Pleasant in the form of the bridge collapse. And it just occurs to me to ask, do you ever talk about dreams with Mr. Kiel? Was he the kind of person who would, in a letter or in a conversation, tell you about his personal dreams?
Absolutely not. I don't remember anything about that. I know that you're referencing Mary Hyde and her dreams about the Christmas packages floating in the water.
Exactly, yes.
She had. They really were the precursors to the bridge collapsing. But I remember, Kiel going on and on about creatures and spook lights and names and different things like that. He really didn't talk even as much about himself as Ivan Sanderson would in some of his letters. And Kiel very much stuck to the points that he was trying to get across as far as I told the other day, one funny time that I was with Kiel and James Mosley it was a Holiday Inn, the kind of the lobby out front. They were the kind of two older guys, and I was this very young 24, 25 year old, and they said, "Oh, we're going to go off to the strip club." I've never been in a strip club, and I certainly wasn't even with these two grand dames of ufology back then. I wasn't going to go off to that. But that's about the most personal that I ever saw Kiel. That he was, and James Mosley told me the other day they never went. They just talked about it. And of course, Mosley's very out being gay, and so it probably wouldn't have interested him the same way that interested Kiel.
Indeed. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Well, Mr. Lauren Coleman, thank you so much for joining us on your birthday to talk about the works and life of John Alva Kiel. I really appreciate you. Folks can go to laurencoleman.com, copycateffect.blogspot.com, and cryptomundo.com and find all of Mr. Coleman's wonderful works that deal with the same areas that John Kiel dealt with and more, much, much more. Thank you for joining us. This is Smiles Lewis signing off.
Thank you.
Bye, Lauren.
Bye, Smiles.